This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is Cullen Murphy, speaking with us today about the 700-year history of the Catholic Inquisition. Your new book, Cullen, comes with the title God's Jury, The Church Sitting in Judgment of Human Error and Mortal Sin. You account not only for the medieval Spanish and Roman Inquisitions, but also for the inquisitorial impulse as it has been made evident in the modern world. What, then, is the objective of an Inquisition, the notion of an all-seeing eye apparently to be found in Inquisitions, both religious and political?
Let me start with the notion of an inquisitorial impulse. It really begins with the idea of moral certainty, the notion that you possess some important truth and that the truth is so great and its implications for humanity so profound that you need to impose that truth on everyone. That's how it begins. But that is not enough. You need to have certain tools to impose that truth and to give it life across generations. This is one of the main things I'm looking at in the book, which is, what are those tools? How do you institute a regime of repression that goes on for generations and for centuries? And when you look at that question, you begin to see the Inquisition looks, at least to my eyes, strangely modern.
Before we get to the modern, and by which I mean, I think you probably mean Stalinist Russia, Nazi Germany, even to some extent our own National Security Agency, but where does the Inquisition that we know first take root?
Well, everybody knows the word. That's something that you can pretty much take for granted. And in my experience, everyone knows the Monty Python line. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. I'm not sure everyone is well-versed on a few historical basics. So let me just really quickly run through some of the Inquisitions. First point, there wasn't just one Inquisition, there were a lot of them. And I'm not going to mention them all. You can divide them into three basic groups. One is the medieval Inquisition. Its targets are Christian heretics, you know, often in southern France, northern Italy. These were people known as the Cathars, and they were, you know, ultimately wiped out. In essence, inquisitors were deputized by the Pope. They went into towns and villages and cities. They took over, you know, the bishop's palace. They brought people in for questioning, often people who had been denounced. They brought them before tribunals. They sentenced them. Some percentage, not a huge percentage, but a significant percentage, were burned at the stake, and others had other penalties. Then a couple centuries after that, you have the Spanish Inquisition. Its targets were very different. It wasn't Christian heretics like the Cathars. It was Jews or people whose ancestors had been Jewish and converted to Christianity. It was also Muslims. And one way in which the Spanish Inquisition was different was that it was controlled by the state. It was a case of not exactly a theocracy, but the king and queen, Ferdinand and Isabella, who started it, they were in charge. And the Spanish Inquisition went on for a long time. It wasn't really ended until the 19th century. And then finally, there is the Roman Inquisition, which starts with the Protestant Reformation. The Protestant Reformation, as we all know, was a huge threat to the church. The Vatican decided to dust off its inquisitorial procedures. It ran it directly from Rome. The Roman Inquisition is the one that put Galileo on trial. It's the one that burned Giordano Bruno at the stake, and it's the one that created the Index of Forbidden Books, which in my Catholic childhood was kind of a five-star rating for a lot of books that didn't turn out, in fact, to be as fun to read as the fact that they were prohibited would suggest. There's a nutshell version of the Inquisition history.
An Inquisition, as you say, entails a bureaucracy and the keeping of records. A repressive regime is a record-keeping regime. And you've actually been in the archives of the Holy Office of the Inquisition in the Vatican. What does that look like?
Just south of Bernini's Colonnade, there is a palazzo, and it was built in the 16th century. It's currently the headquarters of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which is, to this day, the Vatican's theological watchdog. But centuries ago, it was built as the headquarters of the Inquisition. And about 12 years ago, the Vatican, it was actually Cardinal Ratzinger, now the Pope, who made this decision, decided to open most of the Inquisition archives to scholars. It was a big step. The palazzo is like many Roman palazzos before they excavated and made a new space. It looked like a wonderful old library, documents bound in vellum or leather. groaned on shelves. There was statuary. There were old paintings. There was a musty smell. But of course, what these documents are is the haunting thing, because, you know, many of them, for instance, are records kept by notaries of the meetings of the Inquisition, and, you know, very detailed. There's another document that I looked at, which is not in the Vatican. It's actually in the British Library, and that's the Book of Sentences of an inquisitor named Bernard Guy. This book was in effect, the summation of his career. It was all the people he had interrogated, all the sentences he had meted.
What century are we in with Bernard Guy?
With Bernard Guy, we are in the early 14th century. And so all the sentences that he had meted out, the punishments, and so on. But as you look through that book, one thing that stands out is that it's kind of a search engine. It is very carefully indexed. You open the front of the book and the names of everyone in the book is listed there, the towns they're from, the page numbers in which you can go and find more information about these people. And you begin to see that the techniques that the Inquisition was using in terms of administration and information technology, as we'd call it now, were actually becoming very sophisticated.
Doesn't Guy also give us an instruction on how one is supposed to interrogate presumed heretics?
Yes. The Middle Ages was very big on instruction manuals, another part of becoming modern. You know, you find instruction manuals for how to hear a confession, or instruction manuals for prince on how to become a king. And one of the things that Bernard Guy left, and there were others of this kind, was an instruction manual for interrogation. And at one point, I just placed side by side, not Guy's manual, but another inquisitor's manual, Nicholas Amorick's. I placed that side by side with the Army Field Manual, the current one, just to see whether they're on the same page, more or less. And it's kind of uncanny. You understand that when it comes to the tricks, the ruses, the psychology of interrogation, not much new has occurred in recent years. Middle Ages had it down pretty well.
Like good cop, bad cop, by questioning the witness in the presence of instruments of torture?
Well, yes. One of the great phrases is in conspectus tormentorum, which means, you know, in the view of the instruments of torture. And that simply meant that, you know, before questioning started, to get the witness in the right frame of mind, you would bring him or her into the room and just show them what the future might hold, and that in itself could be enough. Just to give you an example of another technique, there was one called, that the Army Field Manual calls, the emotional futility approach. And there's a medieval version of this, and the wonderful thing about these manuals is they write everything out with sample dialogue. So you feel like you're in the room, and you get the questions, you get the answers, and so the medieval version of the emotional futility approach is, you know, the inquisitor says to the person being questioned, you know, I've got one or two more questions for you, and I'd love to wrap this up, but I've just been called away on a trip, and it could take 9 months, so, you know, a year, but as soon as I get back, we'll finish up those questions, unless maybe you can give me the answers, like, right now, and we can call an end to this. So there are lots of techniques.
Was it most often the judgment had already been formed? I mean, do the inquisitors come into the interrogation pretty well knowing in their own minds that judgment has been passed?
For the most part, people weren't brought to that final stage of coming into a tribunal if the inquisitors didn't think that they had the person that they wanted and were going to be, in effect, convicting them of something. What they wanted was a confession, and they wanted a confession because it was really the only form of proof that they really could rely on. They were wrong-headed in certain ways, but you can sympathize with the fact that they wanted, by their lights, to be sure that they were doing something that was proper, and the only way they knew was to have a confession. Of course, they cross a line, because when they couldn't get a confession, then they went the next step and decided, well, torture could perhaps get a confession. So in all of these cases, the ultimate aim is to get a confession.
Describe just one of the means of torture. They had a form of what we now call waterboarding.
Yes, it's not just a form of waterboarding. It is waterboarding. I was always taken aback when the subject of waterboarding came up during the Bush administration, when people would make the argument that this was, well, to use Dick Cheney's words, a dunk in the water, also tried to make the case that this wasn't torture. Well, you can play semantics, but it is the same technique that the Inquisition used, and the Inquisition was forthright about saying that it was torture. It didn't dance around the matter. And waterboarding involves, well, picture yourself on a plank, and you're tied down, and the plank is tilted so your head is lower than your feet, and a cloth is put over your face, and then water is poured onto the cloth. And the sensation that is produced is that of drowning. And it is not just a sensation. It's an actuality. If it persisted, you would die. Christopher Hitchens, my late colleague at Vanity Fair, allowed himself to be subjected to waterboarding and wrote about it. And it's an extraordinary piece of journalism and leaves no doubt that this is torture, and also leaves no doubt that if you persisted in this, you would kill people.
You've seen other parallels. I mean, you not only went to the courtyard of the Vatican and the Holy Office, but you also went to the archives of the Stasi, the state police in East Germany, and you looked at the archives kept by the regime in Nazi Germany. You've also seen parallels in our own. We now have something like 800,000 people employed in our various national security agencies.
Doesn't that make you feel better, Lewis?
No. And we have the airport security futility, which is a bureaucracy. But again, draw some more of the parallels and how you see the Inquisition as a harbinger of the modern world.
So let's pause for a second on the issue of bureaucracy. One of the things that you notice when you're looking at the Inquisition, you know, take the Roman Inquisition, for instance. This is something that goes on and on and on for a long period of time. And you get the sense that it has achieved a kind of autopilot status. And bureaucracies do this. You don't need to have a powerful leader in order to keep them going. In fact, part of the point of a bureaucracy is that it keeps going kind of on its own. And when you have a bureaucracy that's devoted to something like, you know, repression or censorship, thought control, this becomes a very problematic practice indeed. The Stasi archives, Stasi was the East German secret police, and of course East Germany is no longer there. When the Berlin Wall came down, the Stasi tried desperately to destroy their archives, and by one estimate they managed to destroy about 5% of it, and they had, I think, 1 billion pieces of paper in their archive. And the Stasi is just a wonderful natural experiment of what bureaucracies do. Many people will have seen the movie The Lives of Others. They gathered information on virtually everyone, and they wrote it down, and they filed it away, and they just kept doing this and doing this. And in a sense, they lost all perspective on what it was that they were supposed to be doing, which in itself, of course, was not a good thing, what they were supposed to be doing. But this was a bureaucracy that had its procedures. It followed its procedures kind of thoughtlessly for decade upon decade.
The modern world has also developed the techniques of, as you say, the search engine and the surveillance along the lines of, but far beyond what the Inquisitions could accomplish. Talk about Britain and the tunnel of truth.
The tunnel of truth. I remember my eyes picked up, if that's the phrase, when I came across those words. Britain, I think, as many people know, has a very advanced, perhaps it's not a full-fledged surveillance state, but there sure are a lot of people watching you. There are something like 4 million closed-circuit TV cameras blanketing the country. And I think it's fair to say that the security apparatus that governs ordinary life is just far more advanced in Britain than it is in this country. Now, Britain is poised to hold the Summer Olympics, and security is necessarily a big, big deal. And one of the proposals for Olympic security was for something called the Tunnel of Truth, which would be this access throughway that would lead you into Olympic events. And as you pass through this access throughway, you would be monitored by all kinds of things. There would be detectors for facial recognition, machines set up to register biometric information. So that by the time you got through this tunnel of truth, the people in charge would know who you were, and Lord only knows what else they would know if they linked up that database with all the other databases that exist out there. Now, whether the tunnel of truth remains a live option, I don't know.
Colin, you talk about confession being the best of all possible results of an interrogation, but a confession of what in the religious sense and a confession of what today in our secular sense?
The people who were being interrogated had, in the view of the church, done something wrong. They weren't thinking about religion properly, or they had participated in some sort of heretical activity, or in the case of the Spanish Inquisition, for instance, they were guilty of Judaizing, which was if you had been Jewish and then you had converted to Christianity, perhaps under duress, and then secretly were practicing Judaism at home, that was what was known as Judaism. They wanted you to fess up. They wanted you to say, yes, I did this. Yes, I refused to eat pork. Yes, I called the church the whore of Babylon. And once they had that, of course, then they could go to the next step and say, you know, well, guilty as charged, and here's what your penance is. These days, there's no single yardstick. The red line that you would cross in Stalin's Russia or in Hitler's Germany, they were very different, but there were red lines. In our own country, we never got to that point remotely, but we put down red lines of a different kind ourselves. You know, J. Edgar Hoover had files on some 25 million people as he tried to identify who was subversive. Well, just you bring up that word subversive and you're automatically laying a red line down. So what concerns me in the future is what new red lines there might be and the tools that are available to enforce them.
On that not very happy note, thank you, Colin Murphy, for speaking with us today about the history of the Inquisition and its emergence in the modern world. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly from Bloomberg News, copyright Bloomberg 2012.